So welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 20th of January 2009. Hard to believe it's 2009 already. Got another interesting show coming up. First up, we'll have Professor Bill Mitchell. He's from the Centre of Full Employment and Equity up at Newcastle University. A very interesting man. He's one of the academics that's predicting there could be a million unemployed in Australia by the end of next year. This will have devastating social consequences for us all and, of course, for fathers and families. Some of the many traditional jobs in manufacturing and so on could well be lost. The services industry, which tends to be more women involved in the services industries, are standing up relatively well in contrast to other industries, but certainly the old manufacturing industries and mining industries, for instance, are facing very serious circumstances as a result of the global financial crisis. And one of the big stories that will be running in Australia all this year is how the Rudd government, Kevin Rudd, our Prime Minister here in Australia, how that will impact. Now, anyone who wants to listen to the show afterwards, don't forget you can listen to our program at www.dadsontheair.net. And, of course, if you're interested in getting involved in Dads on the Air, you can always contact us. We are looking for material and for new talent. As well as Professor Bill Mitchell, we'll be having Mark Sutton on. He's from the Liberal Arts Radio in the USA. He's discussing Alec Baldwin's book, A Promise to Ourselves, and is also speaking with Susan Block. She's a family law attorney and the former administrative judge of the Family Court of St. Louis County. Liberal Arts is a radio station that explores the arts from an unapologetically political perspective, and he's the host, Mark Sutton. So that should be a really interesting interview, and of course we've already spoken about Alec Baldwin and his book, and very interesting and has a lot of relevance for fathers here in Australia. We'll also be talking with Scott Longdon from the Fatherhood Project in northern New South Wales. He's interviewed at the MAN National Conference in Fremantle, and there'll be two segments from him. And, funnily enough, Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency will have the final word again. There's a lot of stuff going on up in Queensland, and she'll be talking about some of the political events up there. Also, she's one of the few people who have really spoken out loudly about the very sad, very, very, very sad winding back of family law reforms, which are basically being done without proper debate and with what many people would perceive as extremely biased academics who've been involved in this. And so she'll be talking about all that. There's a lot of questions about the resource material that they're using to justify the winding back and justifying claiming that that shared parenting doesn't work, when your grandmother could tell you that kids need both a mum and a dad. In the studio with us today we have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, everybody.
And myself, John Stapleton. So we're a bit light on today, but we'll soldier through nonetheless.
Quality, mate. We have quality, not quantity this morning.
There you go.
Yes, now a couple of articles in the papers this week. In this morning's Australian, under the heading Tyre King Feared Knife-Wielding Wife Would Stab Him, the article in the Australian states, Tyre King Bob Jane says he feared the worst when his wife waved a 30-centimetre knife at him after threatening to shoot him during a domestic argument. Mr. Jane, 79, told a court his wife, Laurie, 41, would not let him leave the couple's South Yarra apartment in Melbourne and threw a remote control at him during a fight in December 2006. Laurie Jane has pleaded not guilty in the Victorian County Court to assaulting, falsely imprisoning and threatening to inflict serious injury on her husband of nearly 30 years. The court heard the couple had been separated for about 6 weeks when Mr. Jane, the founder of Tyre Chain Bob Jane T-Marts, went to the apartment to visit the couple's daughter, Courtney, who had undergone an operation for an ovarian cyst. Mr. Jane told the court yesterday that as he went to leave the apartment, his wife chained the door and stood in front of it demanding he sign legal papers before he left. And there's a extremely sad, morose-looking photograph of Bob Jane sitting outside the Victorian Supreme Court. Our best wishes go to him. It sounds like a shocking situation. Now, on a lighter note, in yesterday's Australian, under the heading Size of Wallet, matters after all. Matthew Clayfield has written, scientists have claimed the size of a man's wallet is directly linked to female sexual pleasure, and wealthy men giving their partners more and better orgasms than those with smaller bank balances. The findings from a Newcastle University study in Britain found both the intensity and frequency of women's orgasms increase with the income of their partner. So, and there's a picture of some young women here. Apparently they interviewed some young women in Sydney who denied it all. Spending the afternoon at Sydney's Rushcutters Bay nightclub employee Kath Savage, who said she met her fair share of wealthy men through her job, said money might lure a woman into a man's bed, but that he was on his own from there. Being wealthy may make people more likely to have sex with you, but it may not necessarily make the sex any better, she said. It depends on the person and how, not on how much they earn. Well, that's according to a Sydney woman, and let's hope there's some truth in that for all us poor people out there. Unfortunately, it seems that sexual prowess and, you know, learning the Kama Sutra and, you know, 37 different positions in a one-night stand and all that ain't going to get you nowhere, blokes. It's all got to do with the size of your wallet.
Well, she would say that too, wouldn't she? You know, that the size of their wallet really doesn't matter. It's all about them. But I suspect there's a lot of truth to that argument. Here's another story from The Age. Women-only gyms are safe from equality law, and this is written by Xavier Lacana, and she writes that women-only gymnasiums would be able to operate in Victoria even if equal opportunity laws are changed to end the single-sex protections granted for century-old private clubs. This has been a huge debate here in Australia, and of course you can listen to Dads on the Air from anywhere in the world via live streaming on the 2GLF website as we speak. But here, anyway, the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission said on Tuesday that women-only gymnasiums were very different to private social clubs that may be affected by a shake-up of the laws. Victoria's Attorney General Rob Holles, a terminally left Rob Holles, has reportedly said that by the end of the year, Cabinet is likely to consider changing the Equal Opportunity Act. Automatic exclusions used by men-only organisations like the 170-year-old Melbourne Club at the 141-year-old Athenian Club will be up for consideration and could be changed. Such a move could force them to accept women's members, while women-only social clubs like the Lyceum Club may have to allow male members. Now, all these men have been pilloried and portrayed as reactionary old, we can't say on radio, but reactionary old things.
Fuddy-duddies, yes.
Fuddy-duddies. But women-only clubs aren't copying the same treatment at all. And, for instance, some of the pools out in this area in Liverpool, for instance, will have times when there are women-only segments, as far as I understand, and particularly for Muslim women, this is a particularly big issue. But if you can have that, why can't you have the opposite, that you can have men-only sections?
Well, because women want equality only in areas where they don't have an advantage, it would appear, and that's one area where they want to preserve their equality, to be unequal, their right to be unequal in those particular things that suit them. But in anything
such as
where
family
men,
law and child support,
well,
yes.
any area where men have the advantage, they want equality. So, you know, it's just the old, good old double standard coming at us again in another form.
What about gay clubs? Don't gay clubs have the right to say, you know, you have to be gay to come in here?
Well, I don't really frequent gay clubs, John.
I'm not suggesting that you do, but isn't it the parallel thing that a club has the right to dictate its own membership? If a male club wants to have male members, surely they should be entitled to do so. And equally for women. If women want women-only clubs, which is an entirely understandable thing,
absolutely.
Why can't they do that?
Well, this is political correctness gone mad. Apparently women can have women-only gyms and men can't have men-only clubs. So that's just what's happening here. This is political correctness gone nuts. Another example.
Okay. We'll be back in a moment. Now, if I don't... We're back talking with Professor Bill Mitchell from the Centre of Full Employment and Equity at the Newcastle University. He's the director up there. Welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Hello, how are you going?
Good. We're all good down here. Hot as, though, I must say. Look, just for our listeners, could you just explain to start with what the Centre of Full Employment and Equity is all about?
Well, it's a research centre at the University of Newcastle, and our main research charter is to do analysis of the labour market and the macroeconomy. We're economists. We have some geographers here who do regional analysis, and so we try to integrate that with our, you know, in an economic geography analysis. And we do quite a lot of social analysis of, you know, impacts of welfare changes, tax changes, those sort of things.
Right. Now, look, you're one of the academics that's suggesting it's quite possible that by the end of next year there could be a million Australians unemployed. Could you just talk about that? Are they... That's a real possibility, isn't it?
Well, it is a real possibility. I mean, already we've got 500,000 unemployed officially. Right. And I think your listeners might like to know that the way in which this data is collected is through Australian Bureau of Statistics in Canberra do surveys, and they ask questions. We split the population up into various categories for the purposes of statistics, and so they first of all ask, did you work more than 1 hour of work in the last week? And if you say yes, you're classified as employed. So the difference between unemployment and employment is 1 hour of work a week.
Right.
1 hour. Mm. And I'll come back to that in a moment. Mm. And then if you say, no, I didn't, and they say, okay, are you actively looking for work? And if you say yes, they then say, are you available to work now? And if you say yes, you're classified as officially unemployed. And there's around 500,000 officially unemployed now.
So they're available for work, looking for work.
And they're actively looking. If you answer no to either of those questions, then you're classified as not in the labour force. So in other words, you're not participating, you're not active.
Mm.
Now, this leads economists like me to ask some further questions of the data. And so if you think about the person who said that they weren't actively looking for work, what's the difference between them and the official unemployed?
Yes, I've always been confused by this, always.
And so typically what happens when the economy starts to slow down as it is now and job vacancies start drying up, people give up, you know, sending letters to possible employers. They give up scanning the newspapers.
Mm.
Yet if you offered them a job today, they would take it very happily because that's what their principal motivation is, to work. And so from the point of view of behaviour and impact on the economy, they have just, while they've given up looking because, you know, they're protecting their self-esteem, they're what we call discouraged workers, or hidden unemployed.
And how many of them are there? Are they?
Well, there's probably about 100,000 of them already. And
sorry, one thing I don't understand is, don't you have to, for a Centrelink application, tick the box that you're actively looking for work, even if you're not?
Yeah, you do, but they mightn't be on benefits, you see.
Ah.
The benefit sort of system is an inducement for people to say they're active, even if they're not. But for many workers, they're not on benefits. Maybe their spouses have got incomes that prevent them from gaining a benefit,
right,
you know, for a means test, and so they have not got that incentive. Now, then you think back to the next group, and that is the workers who are working 1 hour or more a week, and the trend over the last 17 odd years has been for increased part-time work.
Yes.
The economy is generating increasing numbers of part-time jobs, but also increasing numbers of casual jobs.
Mm.
And when the statistician asks part-time workers. Would you like to work more hours? An increasing number of them are saying yes, but we can't get more hours. And this group of people we call underemployed, because they are actually employed because they're working more than 1 hour a week, but they want to work more, but there's not enough hours being offered by employers. And so the official estimates of underemployment now outweigh the official unemployed. There's around 600,000 part-time workers who want more hours but can't get them. And so in effect, their labour is being wasted. They could work, they would happily work more, but they're not able to find a job. So if you add all that up together,
that's 1.2 million.
Yeah, and probably 10% of the, around 10% labour wastage. And this is at the, sort of top of our growth cycle since, you know, this long growth cycle that the Australian economy has enjoyed.
Yes.
We've still got 10% of the available labour forces being wasted. That's the first point I'd make. The second point I'm making, in direct answer to your question, whenever the economy goes into recession, like it's about to go into now if it's not already in recession, the last time was in 1991, and the time before that was in 1982, what you typically see is the official unemployment rate is slow to react because employers make adjustments in terms of hours, for example. They start scrapping full-time jobs and replacing them with part-time jobs. Mm. And we're seeing that happening in the labour market. And the other thing you see is that workers stop participating as much as they were. In other words, the labour force participation rate falls. And if you followed my previous explanation, that reduces the number that can be counted as unemployed. That's the first thing that happens. But then eventually when the economy, when sales are so low and activity is so low, production levels are so low, the firms have no choice but to start laying off workers in you know, large amounts. And the typical pattern would be for the if it's a severe enough downturn, which evidence from the world suggests it will be, the typical pattern is that the official unemployment rate will probably double.
Now, you're saying, aren't you, that the official unemployment figures actually are concealing the real level?
Well, the first point I made was, yes, that they understate how much labour wastage there is. So whenever the previous Treasurer used to boast about the number of jobs that the Australian economy were producing, I always said, yeah, but increasing numbers of them are just underemployed. All you're really doing is replacing official unemployment with official underemployment. Yeah, and a slight improvement, but not desirable. Now, you know, so if you go back in history, in the period in the second half of the 1980s under the Hawke government, the Australian employment growth was very strong, and we got the unemployment rate down to the official rate down to 5.6% approximately by the end of 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then the downturn started, and by the height of the labour market trough, you know, at the peak of the trough, which is probably poor use of words, isn't it? The depth of the trough, you saw official unemployment around about 10.8, something like that. So doubling of unemployment rate. Now, if you think about that, for every 1% the unemployment rate goes up, that's about 125,000 people lose their jobs. Now, so to get 1 million right now, all we need is the unemployment rate to go up by 4%, and that's less than what will typically happen in a recession.
And so what are the social consequences that we're already seeing with this unemployment and underemployment?
I mean, underemployment's an interesting phenomenon because typically an underemployed worker will also be a moonlighter. Moonlighting is when you have more than one job.
Yes.
And so you'll see unemployment typically occurs in the service sector, And it's while male underemployment is increasing, it's still dominated by females.
Right.
And so you'll typically, like a classic example is one that I know of, which is typical, would be someone who does a morning cleaning job.
Yes.
Like 4 a.m. to cleaning building, office buildings.
Yeah.
Who then will go and work in a supermarket for a morning shift, and then in the afternoon will go back to her cleaning job to do the second round to clean the office.
And that would be fairly common.
And that sort of pattern is typical of an underemployed worker. And for the unemployed, they have different life problems because they have no income. They are subjected to a fairly pernicious welfare regime that was made increasingly harsh by the previous government, and the current government hasn't done very much at all to reduce the harshness of that system yet.
Wasn't that, the justification for it, wasn't it, was to actually encourage people into work?
Well, what the Howard government did was refine what I call the full employability model. Don't create enough jobs, but just make sure that you churn people through training programs and welfare accountability, compliance programs like Work for the Dole. It's almost, I used to think of it as an example of, the Merchant of Venice, a sort of Shylock approach that you pay these people a pittance and you've got to, you really take your pound of flesh from them. Now, the problem with it, ideally people should be encouraged to participate and welfare systems shouldn't discourage that. That's I agree with that, but equally, and it's also good to encourage people to upskill and to go into training. But equally, you've got to also ensure that there are enough jobs so that there are meaningful things for people to pursue once they are participating. It seems it's a self-defeating system that just churns people through these programs without a job in sight.
They do have a poor reputation, don't they, the training programs, for occupying people without anything at the end.
The substantial research literature is that job-specific type training, vocational type training, skill development should occur in a paid work environment that is on the job. The trend in the 1990s through to now has been to separate training processes from paid work environment because there weren't enough jobs available, and that'll get worse. And so those type of training where you're out of the context, you're out of the actual, you're not actually doing the job you're being trained for, are very inefficient and largely a waste of time and resources. And, I think that's strong evidence to suggest that.
Right. We're talking with Professor Bill Mitchell. He's from the Centre of Full Employment. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll talk further about employment in Australia today. We'll be back.
Denim in his veins. Whoa, stress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air. And we're talking with Professor Bill Mitchell. He's the Director of the Centre of Full Employment and Equity at the Newcastle University. And of course, Bill, men will be really badly affected, won't they, by this economic downturn and by the unemployment. What's the gender breakdown on unemployment and underemployment statistics at this point in time?
Well, men typically have lower unemployment rates than women, but they typically have much lower underemployment than women.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Women have almost double to 2.5 times the underemployment rate that men have, and that's principally because most of the unemployment is in service sector, where women dominate those sort of jobs. The industries and occupations that men dominate tend to have full-time work. But that's not to say in the recession, when we have a major economic downturn, men do very badly in that type of environment. Full-time jobs are typically scrapped big time and take a really long time to the full-time employment growth to resume. And for a time in a recession, part-time work continues to grow. And that's, as I said earlier, as firms make these adjustments and cut hours and scrap full-time jobs, they want to keep their activity going a bit to meet consumer demand for their products and services. And so they keep as part-time jobs going as long as they can. Now,
seeing that now, aren't we?
We are starting to see that now. Last week, the labour force data, which tells you about employment and unemployment, came out, the latest, and that said very clearly that full-time jobs were scrapped significantly. Part-time jobs grew, and this is a pattern typical of the last...
Do you have
the
statistics in front of you there?
Not really, no.
So, is there an argument that I didn't realise that disparity between the employment for men and women? Is there an argument to say that men are more devastated by the loss of employment because of their traditional roles as the provider and so on and so forth?
That's sort of a value laden argument as to who's got roles and
has. Yes,
but the facts are clearly that. In, say, the Hunter Valley where I live and work, that was severely affected by the 91 recession. A lot of the workforce is highly, is structured across gender. Mm. So the gender, women tend to do service sector and the men do industrial type work, skilled trades, those sort of work. And, when you have a major downturn and, the construction industry, the manufacturing industry, goes south, well, males lose their jobs. And what over the sort of period after the 91 recession in the Hunter, for example, which is not atypical, Western Sydney would be the same, all of the areas where there's manufacturing and trades-type jobs supporting manufacturing, what you saw in that period and what you'll see again is that the males lose their jobs. A lot of the older males, above 50, 55, never really get their jobs back.
No.
In the next growth period, the new flush of young workers coming into the labour force, they outcompete the older males.
Yeah.
And you family dynamics change quite significantly where to... keep the ship floating. The women assume the role of the primary breadwinner. But remember, the women typically dominate low pay, casualised service type jobs, and
so they're working crazy hours.
Family income falls because the wages on offer are much lower in those sort of jobs. The security of the family declines because the type of jobs that become the primary source of income, much less secure than the full-time jobs that the husbands had. And so, you know, the males lose self-esteem because their traditional role is now violated. And, you know, generally it's a bad scene for families, for males individually, for females individually. And it's something that policymakers should do everything to avoid a sharp rise in unemployment like we've seen in the past and like is likely to happen now unless there's some serious policy changes.
Now, it's utterly devastating for these men, you know, say the men in their 50s to lose their jobs, isn't it? It's just their whole identity and their whole role in the community.
They mostly never get back. In the growth phase, they look like damaged goods. A typical pattern that I'm aware of in the Hunter, but also elsewhere, is that those who get redundancy payments, who had slightly more secure working arrangements, which provided for redundancy, a lot of them in the 91 recession, in the period after that, decided they'd set up small businesses, like lawn mowing rounds, sort of small franchises.
Yep.
Most of them went broke, as they do anyway.
Why don't they work, those small things?
Well, small business tends to have very high failure rates in the first year because of lack of ability to, you know, manage a business, basically. Lack of access to capital, lack of skill in managing capital. Lack of marketing skill, in some cases just lack of the skill that's required to do the actual work. But, you know, it's small business at the best of times is a highly volatile undertaking. And for men who were grasping at straws, you know, losing their trade and losing their... unlikely to get back into their positions, you know, these were very risky type undertakings.
And it really flows onto their health, their low self-esteem, and that they get sick and they spend too much time at the pub and all of those things.
Yeah, there's the research evidence is very strong that the cost of unemployment is not just, we've done quite a lot of work on this at my centre, the cost of unemployment is very large in terms of loss of income and loss of production, but that extends to the individual, the social costs, the individual loss of self-esteem then translates, as you say, into there's strong research evidence indicating unemployment and health outcomes are very related, both physical health outcomes and also mental health outcomes. The mental health system gets strained during recessions. And also, the you know, there's a strong incidence of family breakdown during recession as the pressure of the loss of income and also the loss of self-esteem and boredom and all of those things start to play on the family, and typically a lot of families break down at that time. And
these are traditional men in a way. The fact that the woman is now bringing in is now the breadwinner would have a different impact, say, than on a younger 20-year-old male who is much more used to the idea that men and women both go to work, whereas the older males have a different...
That's true, and I mean, but that's not to say that the other sort of dysfunctions that accompany unemployment are, you know, alcohol and substance abuse, and that's certainly... certainly found in teenage males and females who are unable to get jobs. And, you know, the other really stark cost of unemployment is the strain on the criminal justice system as crime rates rise. Stealing, larceny, you know, petty assaults, the crimes then related to the drug taking that occurs because of the devastating effects of unemployment. So these costs are absolutely enormous. They're difficult to measure, but they're enormous, and you know, they challenge the most basic concepts of civilization, that we would allow an economy to generate these sort of devastating effects on the typically the most vulnerable of our population.
What is the actual breakdown of the unemployment figures at this point in time?
In terms of?
Men and women. I mean, how many men are unemployed? How many women are unemployed? Have you got...
I haven't got that data in my head, but women typically have slightly higher unemployment rates than men, and we know that there's about 500,000 official unemployed. There's more women who are underemployed than men by a scale of about 2.5. About underemployment's above 5% of the workforce now. Unemployment's around 4.5%. So we're talking, you know, as I said before, you know, up over 1 million people who haven't got enough work, and 500,000 people without any work.
That's appalling. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll finish up our interview with Professor Bill Mitchell. He's from the Centre of Full Employment and Equity at the University of Newcastle.
Hey now, you better listen to me, every one of you. We've got a lot of work to do. Forget about the women when you want to can. Today you're working for the man.
In distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're talking with Professor Bill Mitchell. He's the Director of the Centre of Full Employment and Equity at the University of Newcastle. Look, Bill, what are the broader policy implications of all this? What should the Rudd government be doing?
Well, I think the lesson of the past is that once the economy goes into recession, it takes many years, up to a decade, to start to resume growth again and employment to sort of get back on track. And meanwhile, over that period, you've got, you know, devastating costs of the sort we were talking about previously. So, you know, the big warning red bell light goes off and says you've got to stop this happening before it gets too bad. And the solution, in my view, I've written papers on this. The solution is that with the power of the federal government, its fiscal power, that is, its spending and tax power, is sufficient to stop any of this really getting out of hand. And so the Rudd government's making steps in the right direction by its first stimulus package. It's probably going to have to be significantly more than that, though.
And that was a $10 billion spend, really, for welfare recipients. Largely.
I mean, what I've been advocating for many years is that the federal government should introduce what I call an employment guarantee as a sort of a buffer at the bottom of the economy that provides jobs to any worker that can't find a job and provides it at minimum wage. And that's the minimum they should be doing. They probably won't do that, but they should be doing that. But then the years of the Howard government saw massive degradation of our public infrastructure. Not only things like schools and hospitals and universities, but also roads and ports and transport systems that really help the private enterprise do their job better. And these are sort of typical nation building exercises, and they require maintenance, they require continual spending, and that we really fell off when we were pursuing all of these surpluses. What the hidden costs of all of that were the really, you know, massive degeneration of our public wealth. And
I could not understand that. Why was a Conservative government so poor on these issues? Why weren't they building ports? Why weren't they fixing the roads?
Well, because they adopted this free market ideology, which said that the private sector would deal with this. And of course, the lessons from that era, and also many other eras, is that, you know, the private sector will not invest in high quality tertiary education. The public sector has to do that. The Australian private sector is notoriously bad at investing in research and development. The sort of things that create wealth in the future have typically come from public sector investment, and so an ideal target. Now, we saw it just earlier, just at the weekend, it was announced that Sydney University is going to expand a research centre in diabetes research and employ several, you know, 100 people, and as a federal government and state government initiative. These are the sort of things that governments can do. Not only create jobs for the disadvantaged in community development, that I advocate that, but also to build capital infrastructure, invest in the future. The really sustainable things the government can do are make sure that everybody who's got capacity reaches that capacity through education and training. We've got to revitalise the apprenticeship system and get rid of these stupid new apprenticeships that really just teach people to flip burgers. We've got to get back to, you know, really proper fundamental training. We have to invest in digital technology. You know, Australia, one of the legacies of the Howard years are that we lag behind in digital capacity. You know,
the broadband in Australia is just an absolute disgrace.
That's something that federal governments can use their spending capacity to achieve, and therefore create jobs and reduce the the devastating effects of as private sector spending falls for the time being.
And Newcastle will wind up, but Newcastle is a classic example, isn't it? As I understand it, the ports there are really fairly hopeless, aren't they? There's a stack of ships waiting to load and unload, and that would be a government way spend, wouldn't it?
Well, we sit up on the cliff where I live, and we count the boats. Sometimes there's 70 big tankers out to sea, and that's because
waiting
to get in and to the coal loaders to get filled up. And you know, one of the stupid things from the Howard years was the privatisation, and this was the state governments as well involved in this, were the privatisation of these coal loaders and the sort of offloading them to the private sector. Well, the private sector took the short term profits and didn't invest in new capacity, and you know, these are things that federal government's got the capacity through its spending to do. They can spend whatever they like. There's no financial constraints on federal government. They're the issuers of the currency, after all. And that, at this time, they should be ensuring that the effects of the world slowdown are minimised. They're going to be negative, but they should make sure that we don't have these huge spikes in unemployment that typically will follow if they're inactive.
We've been talking with Professor Bill Mitchell. He's the Director of the Centre of Full Employment and Equity at the University of Newcastle. Thank you so much for coming on to Dads on the Air. That was a really fascinating interview. Thank
you. You're welcome, John. Take care. Bye-bye.
Right, thank you. Hey, I'm missing. Did you get that picture? We don't want your system. What you got going on? Hey, I'm missing. Did you finally listen? We don't want your fiction. What you got going on? Who are you trying to fool today without letting the truth get in the way? You're the man of fantasy. Making up drugs just to sell on TV. On and on, you try to sing along with our songs, but the words are wrong. On and on. Today, where the people are here, just give away the secrets that you whisper about. Well, it's too late, somebody let it all out. And I believe in none of your sympathy, it's compromised. They say you got a blind eye, well, that won't ever cry. Hey, I'm missing. Did you get that? We don't want your fiction. Oh, what you got going on? Hey, I'm missing. Did you finally listen? We don't want your vision. Oh, what you got going on?
welcome back to Dad's on the Air. Back in August, I attended the MAN National Conference in Fremantle, WA, where I caught up with a guy called Scott Longdon, and he's from the Fatherhood Project in northern New South Wales. Scott runs a program called the Expectant Fathers Program out of Bangalore. I started off by asking Scott what he had enjoyed most about the conference put on by the Men's Advocacy Network.
I think just listening to people's stories and actually getting to hear the effect of the work that they're doing. So, you know, they're getting to make a real difference and, you know, they get to share that with us. And I find that very inspiring. And people are patting me on the back saying, I love the work that you're doing and it's inspiring me to do stuff. And then somebody else inspires me to sort of do more work as well. So I think it's just getting more connected and starting to, you know, remove some of those gaps and barriers.
That's right. It's amazing to find out all the amazing things that people are doing in their own communities around Australia that are really making a difference.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are talking about the need for more service. And what I'm sort of hearing is there are a lot of services and people are really, you're really conscious about the way that they're, you know, they're adapting their service so that it is more father inclusive or it is focused on, you know, the unique benefits that boys offer communities and things like that. But to have a forum where we can all come together with a fairly loose mandate, so to speak, it's a really powerful force. And, you know, everybody here is talking about how it's the, you know, these are the greatest conferences that, you know, they go to, and that's my experience also.
Excellent. Now, you want to tell us, our listeners, a little bit about the program that you run in northern New South Wales?
Yeah, absolutely. We're running this great program, antenatal class for dads, as you mentioned, called Expectant Fathers. And we've been working on this for about 18 months now, and we're quite pioneers in the area of antenatal education. What tends to happen at the moment is, you know, you access sort of public health antenatal classes with mums and dads, and you could possibly get, you know, an hour or so to take the dads away for a breakout session and talk to them about the role of fathering and some of their experiences. And
so this is the sort of, this is the standard model. It's sort of, you go to your local public hospital or whatever, this is what you're likely to encounter.
Yeah, that's what's mostly accepted at the moment, and we certainly do work in that arena, but we've also developed a model where we have a complete workshop for dads only, where we do 3 weekly antenatal sessions, and then we follow that up after the birth of their child with some more sessions. And that really gives us an opportunity to delve a lot deeper into some of the issues that these guys are facing. And, you know, the feedback that comes out of the antenatal classes is, you know, we create this space for them and they really do feel comfortable to share their story, and we give them information about postnatal depression and, you know, the role that they play in breastfeeding, the standard sorts of things. But we also talk to them about how important that fatherhood role really is. And I think on a societal level, we haven't fully got a grasp of what that means yet. We tend to focus a lot on men being support people, and particularly during the labour, that's a, you know, that's a very legitimate, you know, position to take. But once your child's actually born, you know, your responsibility as a father, you know, I believe then is to bond with your child as quickly and as strongly as possible to establish a lasting connection. So we really talk to the guys about how they can do that.
So what you're sort of saying is the existing programs are really talking about the birthing process, at the pregnancy and the birth, but they don't really prepare, I guess, either mum or dad for the 18 years or maybe a lifetime of being a parent.
And, I mean, they're asked to do a lot with the limited amount of time they have in public hospitals, and it's to prepare people for labour. And I'm sure on that particular measure, they do that very well. But for me, that's not my particular interest. My particular interest is in team parenting and, you know, the equal role that mums and dads do play in raising healthy adults. And, you know, it's a lifelong journey. It really is. So we're trying to prepare them for that. And a lot of that is providing them information so they can make informed decisions, but also giving them the skills that they need. Because for a lot of guys, they don't have really any experience in this area. They've held very few babies. They're expected to know, you know, they know that their partner's getting prepared a lot in a lot of cases. And, you know, one of my guys, the dads I work with, said to me, you know, the books are just really stacking up on my side of the bed. You know, can you help me make sense of some of this stuff? Because I'm just getting really confused. So we give them a platform to do that.
We'll be back with more of Scott Longdon after this track.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
I'm at the MAN conference in WA talking with Scott Longdon from the Fatherhood Project in Northern New South Wales.
So what are some of the, I guess, the fears or the worries or the issues, the questions that the guys who come to your class might ask you when they're oh my God, I'm about to become a dad. Yeah. You know, what are some of the things that they throw at you?
Yeah. And, you know, it's important for us to establish rapport with these guys very early on, because we don't want to set ourselves up as the experts per se, because a part of what underpins this program is instilling a confidence in them to talk to other men and other fathers about what's going on for them, because essentially we all have the same fears. And when we open up, you know, when we start to talk about this, it's usually finances. It's usually, you know, how am I going to support my partner during labour? How am I going to settle my baby? You know, these are the superficial things that start to come up. But then we look more deeply. How am I going to fit this into my schedule? You know, how do I cope with the guilt of having to leave my family to go to work and then come home? And know that, you know, in Western society, we, you know, there's this statistic saying that we spend between 3 and 10 minutes, you know, a week alone with our child in the first year of its life. And our partners, our stay-at-home, you know, mothers of our children, they're getting as much experience in the first day as mathematically we get in the first year. So that knowledge deficit then very quickly turns into an experience deficit. So the guys just want to know, how do you change nappies? And, you know, we do a lot of nappy changing exercises and we make that fun. And, you know, we talk to them about baby bathing and they've never done that before. They're very concerned about how fragile, you know, babies are going to be. We show them some basic things.
And is it important, do you think, that they're learning that from other guys? Do you think there's something important about a group of other guys who are either about to be or maybe who are new dads?
Yeah, there definitely is, because they're already very aware that they have less knowledge around parenting than what their partners do. And they're in antenatal classes, and for the large part, they don't feel like they can engage with that discussion. And so, you know, we talk to them about it, and I say to them, you know, do you guys know anything about it? You know, can you learn from each other first of all? And then we show some very basic techniques. And for me, one of the big things about baby bathing is not really about the hygiene. You know, that's not really my role, but it's about showing them they can hold their baby, and when they push their little baby's feet up to the bottom of the bath, you know, the little bub will push off. And straight away, they're engaging with a game, with a form of play. It's a game, and before you know it, your baby's kicking further and further along the bath. You're getting wet, you know, so it's a bonding and attachment exercise. And I think that's, the guys respond to that with us, learning from us.
And do you, in the final session that you have after the birth, or actually even any of your sessions, do you get other dads back who maybe did your program a year or 2 years ago who've got little ones who can maybe, you know, talk, I guess, share their experience of what it was like for them going to the new dads who are about to go through it all?
Yeah, we absolutely do. And we've sort of designed the program with a mentoring component. So again, you know, we learn to learn from each other and not necessarily experts. And on the third week of the antenatal session, we invite a couple of the dads back. And quite recently, we've had, you know, a couple of three-month-olds come in. And the men get to see, you know, the expectant fathers look at this guy and, you know, he seems really confident with his baby. And they go, this was essentially me 6 months ago. So they get to sort of see that there is a progression there and that people do make that transition. And it's aided when these guys tell their story, you know, the guys that come in with their babies. I was in your position and I was really scared. And I had, you know, they share their fears. And they can also talk about some of the ways I've managed to cope with having their baby. So it's not really just us as facilitators, you know, giving the guys information, but they're learning from each other. And we get guys that wanting to come back into the classes all the time. The feedback is really great. You know, I couldn't believe, you know, how great, you know, this program was. And I didn't realise at the time antenatally how big of a difference it actually made to me as a dad and then my, you know, my child, but also with my partner, because we talked to them about the importance of, you know, working together. And I think, you know, one of the other benefits that we see is that sometimes from the sessions that we do with dads, then they go back to the antenatal classes at the hospital. And the feedback I get from the antenatal educators is that it actually transforms the group cohesion. They can't believe that, you know, 1 week they're relatively disengaged and the next week they're coming in and they're asking questions and they're actually talking to their partner more about what's going on, and, you know, they're really making much more of an effort because they realise that it's actually something there for them to get out of it.
Now, there's this myth out there that men and fathers, you know, get them in the group and they, you know, they don't talk much and, you know, they're not like women and, you know, and they're all going to be shy and keep to themselves and don't talk about their feelings. I mean, is that your experience of the guys in your group?
It starts out that way. It's quite difficult to get the dads to make, or the men to make that initial step and to join this program. But once they do that, I mean, we run a two-hour program. We're there for 4 hours quite often. You know, we really can't get the guys out of there. Once we start the group, and it's very relaxed to start with, and it's informal discussions, and, you know, we're sitting around in our chairs and we're having, you know, cuppas, and, you know, it's very relaxed atmosphere. But then we can, you know, the next week we can hit some deeper issues and we start to talk to them about, you know, the role that their dad played in their upbringing and, you know, the strengths of that as well as the weaknesses, because we all, you know, we've got some stuff that's there. And, you know, Steve Woodolf talks about fatherly inheritance, and he said, you know, it's a mixture of utter garbage and priceless treasure. And I really try to get the guys to wear out, you know, the garbage, but also to understand the treasure, so that they can then take that into their, you know, role as fathers.
Well, Scott, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on Dads on the Air today, and all the best with the project. I hope it goes from strength to strength.
Thanks so much, Greg. And I'd just like to share one brief story before I go. We were at the conference last night at the dinner, and I actually got a text message from, you know, back on the East Coast from a dad that's in my program that sort of texted me to say, you know, we're in first stages of labour and, you know, this is where we're at and, you know, we're going to let you know exactly when we have the baby. And, you know, that to me sends a clear message that these guys really appreciate the service that we're offering them. And we're developing our community. We're developing a really strong friendship. So thanks so much for supporting the work we're doing, Greg, and having us on Dads in the Air today.
No worries. Now, before you go, is there a website or anything if people want to find out a little bit more about your work?
Yep. Contact us via the Fatherhood Project, which is fatherhood.com.au, and, you know, in Bangalore, and speak to Colin George or myself. And, you know, I'd also like to acknowledge the work that Dave Hughes has done with the Northern Rivers Area Health Service. He's been instrumental in this program, and he's a great influence for mine, and so you can contact him there also.
Great. Thanks again, Scott.
The splendid efforts of Greg Anderson, who's been a wonderful attribute to Dads on the Air. Next up, we have a song from Seal called Prayer for the Dying. I want to dedicate this to a friend of mine, Colin Griffith, who's in hospital at the moment and I don't think has much time with us on this planet. It's called Prayer for the Dying. It's for Seal, and it's for Colin Griffith, who was a wonderful old friend and a pioneer of liberation in the 70s, and a wonderful man, Colin Griffith. Thank you.
just don't know what's got into me. It's just a prayer for the dying, for the dying.
We're back with Dads on the Air. And we have on the line with us Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency up in Brisbane. Welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Good. Always good to have you on. You've always got the final word, it seems.
It's good, isn't it? I'm getting used to it. Oh, you'd be spoiling me there.
Yes, the final word.
Yeah, last word, Sue.
Yes, good. Oh, well.
Better. What are we talking about today?
Right. Well, I gather there's a lot going on up in Queensland about false accusations. I wonder if you could just background us on all that.
Oh, yes. Look, we had a notion that the Liberal National Party were going to talk to some people. I'm not directly involved, but I am aware of the case. Dr. Travis Gee has put forward a proposal that we need a commission that will review some of the criminal cases that involve perhaps rape, child abuse, those sort of things, because we've got several examples that is really a new class of injustice and miscarriage of justice, and we need those cases looked at by an independent forum. The trouble is what's happening, that when a person such as Bill Darcy, who was a Labor MP here for many, many years, and he was accused of offences against children when he was a school teacher in a country school about 30 years ago, and he was convicted of a number of offences, and he went to appeal, and he failed on his appeal, and he was incarcerated for probably 7-8 years, something like that, and he's now been released on parole. But he has always claimed his innocence, and there's a considerable body of evidence and some very influential people who are supporting his claim that he is innocent.
Now, can for our listeners, go back and say what this case was about? As I understand it, it was a 30-year-old case where he was accused of abusing a child in a classroom, in front of a class.
Well, yes, one of the major parts of the case was he was supposed to have penetrated this child as she sat on his lap in front of a class full of school children, and she didn't cry out. There was no physical signs of evidence of her being abused in such a way. And apparently it was witnessed by another person who came forward to give evidence, but they have evidence now to say that that person wasn't at the school until 2 years later.
And this was how many years after the alleged event?
Oh, quite a number of years, John, a long time.
Decades?
It was a long time afterwards, and the people who made the complaints, whom I believe are encouraged to complain under the promise that they may get criminal compensation for any offences against them, were refused compensation because the cases were considered too old.
Right, but nonetheless, this man went to jail.
This man of offences that he has maintained his innocence about, and we have a couple of very senior police officers who were not involved at the time with the inquiry saying that he is definitely innocent. He has been falsely convicted, and it's a real miscarriage of justice.
Now, why was this man targeted? Was he a high flyer in the Liberal National Party?
He was in the safest Labor Party seat in Queensland, and although he wasn't terribly popular because people considered that he didn't perhaps put in the effort that he might have done into the seat, it appeared that the Labor Party wanted him out. They needed the seat for someone else.
But he was a Labor Party politician.
He was Labor Party, but he was one of the old school, and there was a new boom coming through, and they wanted changes.
Unbelievable.
So there are some allegations that I won't go into here because they're a bit. I haven't got the proof in front of me, but there are allegations that there is a fair amount of conspiracy involved in what happened to Bill Darcy. So, it's one of those issues. We desperately do need an independent review body. What happened with this one, Darcy prepared a petition for a pardon to the governor, and that went forward to Linda Lavarch, who was the Attorney General at the time, I believe, and she forwarded it back to the police to investigate themselves. The two major officers were given the job of reporting back on the allegations. Had they hidden evidence? Had they not disclosed evidence? Had they got the whole case wrong? And, of course, they responded with a report that totally exonerated them of any wrongdoing. But the interesting thing is they didn't sign their reports. So, otherwise, they couldn't be prosecuted for, again, committing perjury to an official inquiry. But, you know, that's what's happening here in Queensland, and that is why we do need an independent criminal review board to have a look at these cases where it is possible that a person has been falsely accused and falsely imprisoned.
And are you claiming that this actually happens fairly often?
Oh, I've got four cases on my desk at the moment of people being similarly accused of abuse of a child or rape of a woman, and they are claiming their innocence. And in some cases you don't always believe what you're told, but there's significant evidence to say no, they didn't do it. But you know, a couple of them have been jailed. It's been a continuous thing since we started Men's Rights that we get approached by quite a lot of people who are already in prison, who say I didn't do it. I've been through appeal. I can't go any further. There's nothing I can do. So it is a problem. It is a problem created by this agenda setting that we have that's got to create women. Seems to be we've got to present women as being victims the whole time. And, of course, you know, when you keep telling women they're victims, they're going to adopt that mantra eventually. And we'll have problems with that because they take on board every little slight against them. And it's a bit like the footballers, isn't it, when they have a night out with the footballers and the footballers don't ring them the next morning? Suddenly what happens?
They claim rape.
They claim rape.
Mm.
And this is, you know, it's an affront to them. They're, and it's a payback. It's noted as being a payback way to tell a guy, well, don't do that to me again. You know, don't do that to anyone again. But it's not justified. When someone enters into a liaison that's fully consensual sorry, my dog's going off.
Yes, we can hear. It's now become a world-famous dog. What's his name?
Yes, I'm sorry. It's Will.
Will. Will the famous. Willful. Sue's famous dog.
Short for Willful.
Willful.
Sorry, he's a bit noisy. I'm sorry. But,
You're right.
We've got this great problem that our laws are being manipulated and being changed in favour of the victim, if the victim is a female or a child, and they are discriminating severely against any man who might be trying to claim his innocence.
And your argument is that this does as much harm to the women as to the men because it encourages them to see themselves as victims rather than to take responsibility for themselves.
Oh, exactly. I can't understand what the feminist movement is thinking about when they sort of they keep on saying, you know, but women are victims, they need protection, they need all this. We should be saying to women, you know, you're not a victim of this. You're an adult, sensible person who is entirely capable of making their own decisions, and those decisions can involve making safe decisions for themselves. They don't need to be mollycoddled, which is what we're doing.
Now, what was the latest in this? What has happened today?
Oh, the Australian ran an article on this a forthcoming meeting with the Liberal National Party, which was to be held on Wednesday, where Travis G was going to speak about this very subject that we've been discussing, and a number of other people. And of course, it hit the newspaper today with Liberal National Party to host talk to aid paedophile. And lo and behold, by 8:30, I'm being told that the meeting's been cancelled. The Liberal National Party have backed out at a million miles an hour of being anywhere associated with any speech that is going to talk in general about the need for a criminal investigation commission, especially if it's going to be associated with someone like Bill Darcy. He's been well and truly tried and convicted, is their opinion, and that's the end of the story. There's no room for a thought that he might be innocent.
How many years is he spending in jail?
I think he spent about eight or nine years. It's quite a long time, and he's out on parole now.
Right.
So it was a long sentence.
Look, we've only got a few more minutes.
7 years of an 11-year term.
We've only got a few more minutes, and I really wanted to for you to mention what's happening with family law reform. And there's a lot of talk about it being wound back, basically with very little analysis. Well,
we predicted that at the end of last year and before the end of last year, because the signs are that there's a lot of research going on behind the scenes with the Institute of Family Studies, the various universities, and the women's groups are very busy trying to roll back shared parenting by claiming that it's damaging to children, which nothing could be further from the truth. But it's very selective studies. I think ex-family court judge Chisholm was involved in one of the first studies with the psychologist. You have to help me out.
And he's the one that wrote that silly ditty against men for the national conference about fathers on the top of the spaghetti hill or something. And
I
don't think there is a single example of him ever saying a positive thing about fathers or their importance to children, is there?
I haven't come across anything like that. And, of course, he was in company with Jennifer McIntosh in writing his report. But Jennifer McIntosh, as far as I know, she's written three papers which... she bases her results and her findings on very, very small samples. And the one about children viewing their parents being violent or domestically abusive to each other doesn't even consider the fact that women can be just as abusive as any father as well. So, you know, if you're coming from that single-minded tunnel vision viewpoint, how can you talk in general and with any independence about what is good for children in the long run in seeing both their parents?
And these are very
bigoted attitudes.
And these are very reactionary elements within the family law industry, aren't they, that are really trying to wind back the clock?
Oh, yes, entirely. We're seeing it all over the place. There's I bought a book the other day which is about family law. It's a professional's guide, I suppose, but I was reading the things about the sexual abuse and false allegations, and, of course, they follow all the claims that, oh, very few allegations are falsely made. Most sexual abuse is committed by the fathers, which is totally wrong, absolutely wrong. The figures don't support that at all. Like less than 1% of child abuse is committed by a biological father. A third is committed by other siblings, and the rest by other relatives and other unknowns. So, you know, fathers are the person most likely to protect their children.
You'd never guess from the rhetoric coming out of these people, are they? They are so reactionary, aren't they? That's
well, it's quite horrible. I don't quite know where we go to turn it around, but I know one thing that is for sure. If we want our children to have a decent life ahead of them, we need to turn it around, and we need to convince people that the vast majority, and I mean the vast majority of men and fathers, are very good people, perfectly good people, trying to do their very best to look after their families, raise their children in a healthy lifestyle, and they would have not a bar of any of this type of thing.
No, it's an absolute travesty what's going on, and it seems to be going on so secretly.
Yeah, of course it is, but I just want to just let you know. We were out at lunch on Sunday, and it's just a little story.
We're very short of time, Sue.
Let me tell you, there was a party, a birthday party for 25 people. Of those 25 people, there were only two men there, and there were seven children. Mm. That's our family of the future. The majority were women of all ages.
Yeah.
There were no men. Two men only.
It's a travesty, isn't it? Mind you see in Sydney now that, you know, fathers, the kids are all over the dads these days.
Of course they are. They want to be over them, and it's delightful to see it, and we should be applauding that, and we should be celebrating that. But all we hear now is pushed to us by politicians, that politicians are the leading offenders in having a go at dads. You've only got to look at what Joe Ludwig puts out.
We're out of time, Sue.
Okay.
Thank you so much for coming on to Dads on the Air. That was Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency up in Brisbane. Thank you so much. We'll
Bye-bye.
Be back next week.
And, of course, you can hear this program on dadsontheair.net. It should be downloadable by sometime this afternoon or tomorrow morning.